You're listening to Start Writing, where we explore the great minds behind the greatest stories. Hosted by Joseph Bendosky, author of the Skyfall series, and Jay Washburn, author of the Star Child space opera. Hi, this is Jay Washburn, and I would like to introduce you to Max McCoy. I've recently been doing a ton of research on Indiana Jones, and I decided if I was really going to become an expert, I ought to read at least a few of the novels. And so I looked them up by their covers, and I was trying to decide from the covers which one looked most interesting, which obviously is a bad idea. You know that. I know that. Just judging by the covers, I thought that Indiana Jones and the Dinosaur Eggs sounded like perhaps maybe the low point in the series. I ended up deciding to just read all of them, which turned out to be a ton of fun. When I got to the third author who had written Indiana Jones novels, that was Max McCoy, and I was just blown away by the quality of his Indiana Jones novels. They were not the cheesy Pulp Fiction that I was expecting from the Dinosaur Eggs cover. And in fact, that one and all of Max McCoy's Indiana Jones novels are favorites of mine. I just think he is a stellar author. But that then got me to peruse some of his other books, and I thought his Ophelia Wilde novels might be about a quaint little old lady in the Old West, but it reminded me a bit of the Dresden Files, where you have this matchup of two ideas, two exciting ideas coming together. So the Dresden Files is obviously a wizard in modern-day Chicago, I think. This had a similar vibe, where it was the Old West meets this cool fantasy action hero. And man, it was a blast. Exciting, fast-paced. I've read a few of his other books too. I'm just over and over impressed by Max McCoy and how he is able to tell a story with such preciseness and in few words. Very impressive. And I am truly honored to have him as a guest on Start Writing today. I would also just like to add that Joe, my co-host, is suffering through a personal tragedy right now. And if he ever wants to talk about that, that will be up to him. But I just wanted to invite you to send him your prayers and your appreciation, because I think he could use it right now. Without further ado, here is our interview with Max McCoy.
Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me, Jay?
Yeah, I hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Awesome. Man, thank you so much for taking the time. How's your day going?
It's okay. It's been a busy day, but you know, that's sometimes good. So
are you teaching classes?
Yeah, I had a mass comm class about an hour ago. So
yeah, cool. Okay, well, let's jump right into this. I have a ton of questions for you. So
you bet.
So I like to ask guests about their name. I love the last name McCoy. I think it's cool that you use the phrase "the real McCoy" on occasion in your writing. Yeah. Tell me the story of your name, both Max and McCoy.
Well, it's my real name, even though it sort of sounds like it's made up to be a Western writer. I've had people ask me that question: is this a pen name? No, it's my real name. And my mother, interestingly, thought that Max McCoy sounded like a writer. So she had this in mind when she named me. She was a big reader and, was an early influence in my reading. And I guess that makes sense. So, I'm glad she chose that. And my dad went along with it. So,
Yeah. So it was fate all along.
Yeah.
Dang. That's cool. So most of our listeners are novelists or aspiring novelists. And mm-hmm. so I just want you to imagine for a second that you were a character in a novel. What is a quirky habit or maybe something about your writing process that is interesting and memorable that might make you stand out as a character?
That's a great question. I think the most memorable thing would be is that I learned to write late at night. And so my usual writing schedule is between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m., which is kind of an odd schedule, but it came about that way because my first day jobs were in journalism, where they were in newspapers. And after I would finish with my journalistic work, my reporting, then I would sit down and start writing novels and magazine stories. And that's how I got into the habit of writing late at night. And there's some really important benefits to that. And one of these is that you're not interrupted.
Yeah.
During the day, you know, there's just always interruptions. The visitors from Porlock keep coming. And at night, you don't have that. You can turn things off, and at least I can concentrate on things. I know for others that it works to get up early in the morning and do this before the day starts. And that's a good habit, too. But I've always been a night owl since I was a kid, so that's just continued over. It's been tough when I have to teach a morning class or have committee meetings, et cetera. So that's been the toughest part of it, having this dual career as a novelist and also a professor.
Yeah.
But it works. And my wife, who is a poet, does the opposite. She gets up early in the morning and writes. And she likes that. And it works for us. So we divide our time so we're not in each other's way while we're writing. Mm-hmm. And we have the rest of the day to spend together, which I like that.
Yeah. Dang, that's cool. Well, I don't know. I hope this isn't too personal, but so like last night, were you up till 4 a.m. last night or?
Not quite. It was maybe 3:30.
Wow.
So pretty close. Yeah.
Dang.
And I will typically, when I write, I will go longer in terms of my writing sessions as I'm getting closer to finishing a project. So when I'm in the early stages, it might be, 10 to 1 a.m. or 10 to 2. And then as I get closer to finishing, it might go to 4 or 5. And typically when I finish books, it's like 6 o'clock in the morning. And then I'll make a note. I keep a notebook, a journal, and I'll make a note of when I finish a book. And more often than not, it's between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. So.
Well, so do you track all your hours of writing so you know how many hours a given novel takes?
Well, no, I don't do that. I tried and was appalled by the number of hours that I was spending. And the question here is, when is a novelist not working? And I think novelists work all the time. I know when I'm driving somewhere and I'm thinking about, more likely than not, I'll be thinking about what I'm writing. Everything is pretty much research, whether it's, you know, something that's going on with your friends or some interesting place you visited. And how do you gauge what happens in the subconscious? Because I think the really heavy lifting for novelists happens in a way that we really aren't aware of until it comes out on the page.
Yeah.
I tend to plot my novels carefully and then abandon those plans as the novel develops organically. I tend to know where they're going to end up. I tend to know what the last scene is and what the last chapter will be, but how I get there often surprises me in terms of the twists and turns that it takes. I've never had you often hear of, you know, characters taking over novels or something like that. I've never had that experience, but I have had the story unfold in ways that were surprising to me. And I think if it's surprising to me, it must be surprising to the reader as well. At least I hope so.
Well, can I ask, did that happen with your first Ophelia Wilde novel?
Absolutely. That was a lot of fun to write. And I did more research for it than I probably should have. But the research is the fun part. And I'll, let me tell you how that came about, the Ophelia Wilde, first Ophelia Wilde novel. And Ophelia Wilde is a detective who was in 1870s Dodge City, Kansas, and she is a former con woman that she had pretended to be able to speak to the dead. And then in the novels, well, she finds out that she really can speak to the dead. So it's a paranormal mystery. And the way I get to how I created Ophelia, or how Ophelia came to me, I probably should say, is that I was down in Guthrie, Oklahoma, at the territorial capital. And I was researching the history of Guthrie for a novel I was writing at that time that was one of the Hellfire Canyon novels, which are dark westerns. And I had many scenes set in Guthrie. And, you know, I was going through the old newspaper clippings in the state library there. And I came across a bunch of clippings that really fascinated me. And they were about sightings. And this was in the 1890s. Sightings, according to the local paper, of a ghost of a murdered Cyprian, a murdered prostitute that was seen haunting a shack at the edge of the train tracks in town. And the stories went on for more than a week that this reporter was telling about, that local residents would go out and ask the ghost what it needed, what it was trying to do, and there was never any answer. And this is probably one of those newspaper hoaxes that journalists were fond of back in those times, that when things were really boring, they would make stuff up, you know, like the airship stories and all that. But there was something about these stories that really stuck with me, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to have a paranormal Western mystery set, maybe not in Guthrie, but maybe Dodge City. And so that's how that came about. And I wanted to drop the book I was writing at the time and write the Ophelia Wilde, the first Ophelia Wilde book, but I couldn't. And this happens a lot, that you're in the middle of research for a book that you're working on and things are going really well. And then something else will pop up and I have to force myself not to go off on that tangent. And usually these things appear and pass and I'll make a note in my journal or something, but this really stuck with me. And so I did come back and write three novels with Ophelia Wilde as the main character. And they were just a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I'm interested in I can't say I'm a believer, but I'm interested in ghosts and spirits and all of that. Cause there's so much fun to talk about and think about. Was a big fan of the X-Files way back when. And a lot of the stuff that, Richard Matheson wrote, The Night Stalker, the Kolchak stories. So always had an interest in that. Fortean Times is, in my opinion, the best magazine in the world. If you're not familiar with it, it's a British magazine that's named for Charles Fort, the collector of weird phenomenon, and has lots of stories about ghostly sightings and UFOs and paranormal events. So it's always been an interest of mine. And I also teach folklore in terms of some of my classes, particularly Western folklore. Mm-hmm. So this dovetailed pretty nicely into that. And the history of spiritualism in the Old West is fascinating because after the Civil War, there were so many people, so many families had lost members during the war. And there was this renewed interest in spiritualism and contacting the dead because to try to deal with the grief. And so spiritualism was really a very well-defined movement in Victorian times. Of course, it came from the Fox sisters in the 1840s and their stories of having contacted a murdered peddler in their home back east. And which may or may not be true. It seems more of a poltergeist story. One of the sisters recanted, and then she recanted after that. But really a new religion sprang up. And even here in Kansas, we still have a spiritualist community that is still going strong out on the Kansas Plain, not too far not too far from here. And the things that they were saying in the 1870s in terms of spiritualism about contacting the dead, they were just exactly what you hear with contemporary mediums who say they contact the dead, and that, you know, the spirits live on after death, that ghosts who linger have unfinished business, that often you can contact them or you can get them to share with you what it is that they want to finish here on earth. And that sometimes, and this is what really where the Ophelia Wilde stuff comes in, that sometimes the ghosts are not what they appear to be. Hmm. So without trying to give too many spoilers, but those are the things that interested me about Ophelia in the Old West.
So let me ask, so you have a background in journalism, and I just feel like that's very much committed to fact. I'm a sci-fi fantasy writer, and I have on occasion gotten flack for, you know, you're writing fantasy. Why does that matter? It's not real. Have you ever encountered that argument? And like, what do you say that this stuff, you said you're not a believer, but you're fascinated by it. Like, does this kind of stuff have some meaning and some value aside from it's just fun?
I think it must. And I'm an agnostic when it comes to this kind of stuff. Can't say that I've ever seen a ghost, not ruling it out. I don't think I'm smart enough to know what happens to us, if anything, after we die. But your question about between the area between fact and conjecture, my experience as a journalist helped me mostly in, I think, meeting deadlines, being able to structure a story, being able to put two sentences together. And I went into journalism because Hemingway had famously said that to learn how to write, there is no better place than a newspaper. So that's how I went into journalism in the first place. That helped me enormously. In my 20s, I was freelancing to national magazines. And then by the time I was 30, I had my first book with Doubleday. And it all comes from learning to write on deadline for small daily newspapers. Hmm. Now, the question about what is the importance of these stories to us? Are they just entertainment? And I think it transcends entertainment, that it addresses a basic human yearning in us to know what lies beyond. I have to go back to Joseph Campbell and talk about the hero's journey and why stories are important to us anyway. And it's more than just entertainment that I think stories, the best stories give us hope. They give us really a type of survival information, even if it's completely fictional characters. It has to be believable enough for us to recognize, this is a human story. These are characters that I understand or can identify with. And then my next thought about this is that all worlds must be believable. Hmm. So even if you're creating a novel that is set in a fictional space, it still has to have an understandable set of rules, and it must be believable for the reader. So that's important. Yeah. With historical fiction, which I write a lot, if you mention a historical fact, like, and I mention a lot in the Ophelia Wilde novels, I think you owe it to the reader to get those facts right.
Yeah.
You have and I think that adds an extra level of authenticity to the stories too, when you do have your facts right. With Ophelia, for example, Ophelia early on in the first book is mistaken for Kate Bender, a trans medium and a member of the notorious Bender family of just outside Cherryville, Kansas, and one of the first documented cases of serial killers that we have. And we don't know what happened to the Benders. They disappeared. Mm. The Bender family killed 13 people along the Osage Trail, this lonely trail that winds across southeast Kansas, left the cabin empty after a search party went out looking for some of the victims. And we don't know what happened to them, but the details about the Bender family, when I talk about that, and in the book I talk about the Kansas governor offering a reward for the capture of the Benders, all that's true. So Kansas readers would be more familiar with that than others, but I do think it lends something to it. Also, and I talk a lot about Dodge City in the 1870s, and I talk about the deadline, which is the line where you could not bring firearms into town. Mm-hmm. All that is accurate, or as accurate as I could make it. I did a lot of research on it. I'm really not, I do not like I do not like to abuse the facts, because I think they add so much to a story that it's important to get them right. And we all make mistakes sometimes. Sometimes I will get a detail incorrect, and readers will tell me about it. You have to get it right. What readers mostly will tell me about is if I get a detail wrong about a firearm or a piece of technology or something like that. So I try to get those details right.
So
I did get some of the details about the railroad in Dodge City a little bit wrong during that time. I did have people tell me about that, but they weren't substantial or weren't material to the story.
So I wanted to ask a related question. So in Ophelia Wilde, the world is real. Well, aside from the fantasy element, but then the characters you made up. But you've written about Jesse James and Wild Bill Hickok and a bunch of these historical figures. And I'm curious how you addressed, I mean, you're writing a novel, and a novel's fiction, you know, sort of, and but you're writing about Wild Bill. So, and I, as a reader, I don't know Wild Bill's history that well. I kind of know how he died, but I'm not sure where the line is between facts and fiction as I'm reading that. And I'm kind of wondering how you address that, because you're addressing a real life person, but you're making a novel out of it. So how do you blend those two together?
Okay. Another good question. Let's take Wild Bill and Jesse James separately, because I took two different approaches to them. And with Wild Bill, you said you know how he died. And of course, he died in Deadwood, South Dakota, shot to death. He probably wasn't holding aces and eights, as the story is, but everyone knows the story about him dying in Deadwood. Everyone who is even a little bit familiar with the Old West will know that the Hickok-Tutt fight in Springfield, Missouri in 1865 was the first and maybe one of the only examples of really a stand-up gunfight where people shot it out. And in this case, they shot it out across the square in Springfield, Missouri, and Hickok ended up killing Dave Tutt over a pocket watch and maybe over a woman. It's not really clear. So I took those two facts about Hickok's life, the gunfight and the way he died. And there's a lot in between that is unknown. And I use those as signposts for me that I knew I wasn't going to violate stray from the facts of the gunfight or his death. But there's a lot that was just unknown about Hickok. For example, his work maybe as a spy during the Civil War in southern Missouri and northwest Arkansas. And so I found that fascinating, that there was an opportunity to explore that gray line between what is known about Hickok's life and what is really unknown. And even during his lifetime, there were wild stories. I mean, he was the subject of dime novels, etc. So I had a little bit of fun with that in there, too. And the Hickok story is a little darker than maybe people are used to. Probably a good example of one of my darker Westerns. Whereas Jesse is not, really. And Jesse, everyone knows how Jesse died. He died at the hands of Robert Ford in his home in St. Joseph, Missouri, while he was living under the name of Howard. And just remember the lyrics to the song, and you got that. So this is one case where I did change how Jesse died. And I'll tell you why I did it. At the time, I was approaching my 50th birthday, and I was thinking about that. And I just reread Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Mm. And that has a great frame in it, in the beginning about Twain talking, describing visiting Warwick Castle and meeting this stranger who seems to know something about this hole in a suit of armor. And the stranger said, oh, you know, I know how that hole was created. And he said, it wasn't, you know, it was a bullet. And so he, the stranger tells him the story of going back in time, Hank Morgan, the character, going back to King Arthur's time, and then him being magically transported. So I thought that was such a great frame. And I thought, well, one other bit to this before I get to what I actually did in the novel, there is a story that's pretty well documented that that Mark Twain met Jesse James in a dry goods store in Missouri. And Jesse James comes up to him and says, well, I reckon we're about the most famous people in our lines of work. And Twain says, yeah, who are you? And he says, hi, I'm Jesse James. It's a great story, right? So these things were running through my mind. And I thought, well, what if Mark Twain, when he came back to Missouri in 1902 or 1904 to visit Hannibal and all of that, met a stranger who claimed to know about events in Jesse James' life that no one else could know, and that he says, well, I am Jesse. That wasn't me that they killed. And then he tells the story to him, just as Hank Morgan told the story in Connecticut Yankee. And so that was the idea for Jesse. Those are probably the only similarities, because Hank Morgan and Jesse are very wide apart in terms of character. But in that case, I did, the conceit was that Jesse survives the assassin's bullet to tell his story to Mark Twain in the early 20th century. So that's how I came up with that one.
Yeah, dang, that's cool. So that actually leads really well into my next question. I've been researching how creatives, you know, authors specifically, but almost all creatives build on the work of predecessors. And so they take an idea and they say, you know what, I love that, but I think I would do it this way. And just wondering if you have any predecessors that you feel like have really inspired your career.
Too many to mention. It's interesting you'd ask this question, because I was thinking just the other day about my influences, and my early influence, I mentioned my mother and that she was a reader, and at our home in Baxter Springs, she had a little hutch style secretary, and it had a couple dozen books in it. And she was a very eclectic reader. And the books were, and I can picture them as I'm speaking to you, they were the complete works of, or The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, the complete works by Conan Doyle. There was that. There was a book called Go to the Widowmaker by James Jones, who wrote From Here to Eternity. And that book is about scuba diving. There was a book called The Hurricane Years about hurricanes devastating the southern coast during the 1950s. There was also a little 1940s pot boiler called The Foxes of Harrow by the novelist Frank Yerby. And I read these when I was a kid. And it occurred to me a couple weeks ago when someone asked me about my influences, that in my career, I have hit every one of those books that I read in some fashion. Well, you know, there's the Ghost Rifle, which was, I really used the frame from the Yerby novel for that. Completely changed it, but that was my homage to Yerby, because he was still a pretty good writer, even though he wrote these trashy little novels. And God, they were wildly popular. It's made into a movie, too. Back in the 40s. So there was that. The scuba diving. Well, then I wrote The Moon Pool, which is a thriller set against the background of cave diving. And of course, I'm a diver too, but yeah. My interest in scuba diving came from that one book in my mother's secretary. The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Well, I did the Ophelia Wilde mysteries, and that was a big influence on me. So those are my early influences. And other influences, as I grew up and found things on my own, I've already mentioned Richard Matheson, terrific writer who my favorite novel of his is What Dreams May Come, which was made into a movie. And of course he wrote Duel, he wrote the screenplay for it too, which was the first Steven Spielberg. It was a made for TV movie in the 70s. He wrote, I Am Legend, many other things. So he was a big influence. And I have to tell you the story. After I published my first novel, The Sixth Rider, I got an award for it and went to the convention to pick up the award. And this was in Jackson, Wyoming. And I was asked to sit in on a panel, a novelist panel. And I didn't know who else was going to be on the panel. And so you get there and you sit down and, you know, you introduce yourself to the other panelists. Well,
can I just ask, you're a kid at this point. Are you in your late 20s maybe, or?
Probably 30.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Probably 30, at 29 or 30 at that point. I'm a kid and Matheson was about my age, about the age I am now. And you know, he introduced himself and no one seemed to be making a big deal of it. This was a Western writers convention and he had just published a Western called Journal of the Gun Years, which has since become really a classic, in the genre. And I said, you know, I'm so thrilled to meet you. I don't think many of these other people really know who you are. And he said, that's okay. I'm having a good time. And so we chatted and then we traded letters for, a few years after that. And it was really interesting. He asked me, what did I think of my agent? Did I like my agent? How did I like writing? And he gave me some advice. He said, you know, don't let the pressure of the work take away your joy in living and being with your family. And he said his favorite times were camping in the mountains with his kids. And so that was terrific advice. So, not sure I've always lived up to it, but to be able to be at a panel and then to meet someone who had been such a big influence, I can remember when the Night Stalker was on and I was it, 12 or 13 years old when that was, first on TV, I was just fascinated by it. And then when they had the rerun of it and it must've been 6 months or a year later, I wanted to capture it. So I had an old tape recorder and I tape recorded the entire, thing, so I could listen to it later and think about the dialogue and all of that. So, in many ways, Matheson was my primary influence in terms of both taste, these Freudian subjects, and also what a great storyteller. And he was one of the kindest individuals I've ever met. And so what a loss when he died. But I'm glad that I got to know him. Other influences, and it ranges really all over the place in terms of what I'd love to read. I will mention a writer that probably very few people know about now, but who was a giant in the Victorian world, and that was H. Rider Haggard, who wrote, most people know him from King Solomon's Mines. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't his most famous book at the time. It was a book called She. And it was about an immortal who was living, had been living in the desert for ages and ages and eons. And it was about reincarnation. And of course, the Victorians were crazy about anything connected to Egypt and the pharaohs. So H. Rider Haggard was a really big influence in terms of how you structure a story. He particularly liked the frame of having a manuscript within a manuscript. And I've done that a couple of times, so much so that my agent now tells me I have to knock it off. I like it too much, but that's where that comes from. Haggard did a great job of capturing the mood of, I think, a particular period and a particular culture, and the Victorian longing for the transcendent. He did that really well.
Dang, I
and then my other influence.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's really great. It was made into a Hammer film back in, it must have been 1968, 1969. And it starred Ursula Andress is she. It was a really bad movie. Okay, let me preface this by saying, okay, don't go out and see the movie, read the book. But yeah, that was probably the last gasp of in terms of popular culture of she's influence, of that novel's influence. But other influences as I got older, and then studied writing seriously in graduate school. Hemingway, Fitzgerald, more recently Susan Orlean. I think she's a terrific writer. The Orchid Thief is a masterpiece. Gay Talese, nonfiction. Thy Neighbor's Wife. I had a novelist friend who said that it was the most perfectly structured nonfiction book ever, and I agree with him. This was Philip Finch.
That's high praise.
He told me this. Yeah, and I think he was right on. Of course, The New Journalist, Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson. And
cool.
That whole lot. So Susan Sontag as well, terrific essayist. So I just love them all.
Yeah, dang. Well, that's a ton of recommendations. That I have a long list. Let me dive into some Indiana Jones questions.
Okay.
First, I think you're in your mid-30s when you got picked by George Lucas or Lucasfilm. How did you get picked to be the next guy in line?
Yeah, it was after my first couple novels with Doubleday. And I had an editor at Doubleday who was tapped to be the liaison to Lucasfilm. And Lucasfilm wanted to continue the Indiana Jones series with some novels. And this was after the first three films. And Rob McGregor had written the first four books in this series, and Rob did a pretty good job, and it started out, it was something new, and now doing these sorts of tie-ins is not unusual now, but it was a little bit unusual back then, I think, especially to have somebody from the outside come in and be invited into the world. But, you know, Lucasfilm was a pretty receptive to that sort of thing, and after Rob did his four books, Doubleday was looking for someone to take over. And my editor had liked the way that I handled action in The Sixth Rider and Sons of Fire, my first two novels for Doubleday. And he said, do you think you could write a sample chapter? And I said, sure. Of course I said, sure. I didn't make a big deal of it to him, but on the inside, I was, you know, jumping up and down because I remember seeing Raiders of the Lost Ark when it first came out and just being blown away. And I particularly remember, and this was at a drive-in movie theater in Joplin, Missouri, and it was raining, and you know, couldn't see the screen very clearly, but the opening sequence. I mean, I had my head out the car window looking at the screen. I was getting rained on so I could watch this incredible opening sequence with the boulder rolling after Indy and after he takes the, and then Belloc, you know, stealing the statue from him. I remember thinking, gosh, somebody is being paid to write this. And then just not many years later, I was the one being paid to write it. So I sat down and watched the first three movies, made notes, did some research on how Lawrence Kasdan and Spielberg and Lucas all contributed. Kasdan was the screenwriter, all contributed to the idea of it. And after I thought I had a pretty good handle on where they were coming from, and of course I was familiar with Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey, which they had in mind as well. So I sat down and wrote a sample chapter, which became the first chapter in The Philosopher's Stone, which is the first book. And that's how that worked. I had to audition.
Isn't that the Crystal Skull? Is it?
Yeah.
So you have, I love this theme, but each of your four novels begins and ends with this Crystal Skull thing that kind of ties them together. Mm-hmm. which I honestly think is a brilliant idea. I love how it kind of makes those four novels into a series, you know, it pulls them all together. How did you come up with that idea? It sounds like that was the first thing you thought of.
Well, it really was. When I was given the contract after I was given the go ahead after Lucasfilm had looked at the sample chapter, and then I was given the Bible for everything that was known about Indiana Jones. Wait, and I had to sign.
Tell me what that was. That a book or is this a?
Oh yeah, it was a big binder, and it was called the Bible in the industry because it has everything that's known about the franchise and the character, including projects that were reserving for Lucasfilm. And it had things like synopses of the young Indiana Jones stuff, which had already aired on TV. So I couldn't veer from the canon, as it were. There was no alternate universe like you now have with Star Trek or whatever. But that was fine. So I was thinking about, okay, I'm going to have four books and I don't want to just repeat the same thing in each four books. So I wanted an overarching story that would begin with the first one and would wrap up with the ending one. And so that was the Crystal Skull, which is somewhat different than the Crystal Skull as it came out in the movies. But yeah. there are a couple of chapters missing in the very last book because when I wrote the fourth one, Secret of the Sphinx, there is a time travel sequence in the end of it as I wrote it. And the chapters have Indy coming to stepping out of the temple that he's in at the end of the fourth one, where he's trying to return the Crystal Skull. Mm-hmm. And to set everything right, he comes out of the temple, and the temple, that entrance has been moved to the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and he comes out in the 1990s, so it's contemporary. It's almost the turn of the 20th century, and there are a couple chapters, and Lucasfilm did not like that because they wanted to reserve the time travel thing.
Really?
But there are some clues to remaining in that last book to the time travel, what really happens. And some readers have figured it out, particularly when Indy is, and of course, Indy teaches at Princeton. So he's near Einstein, where Einstein was living and working. Mm-hmm. So he sits on a bench and he talks to Einstein about space and time. And so that's the biggest tip off there. But yeah, it was a lot of fun, and I liked having the continuing story of the Crystal Skull. But it was all because I didn't want to repeat the same thing over and over.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so that's interesting. So I don't want to give away spoilers to any readers, but Alicia Silverstone, I think is her name. There's kind of an ending to her arc in book three, which I would have thought might happen in the fourth book. And so that made me, as a reader, I thought, oh, I'll bet he wasn't planning to write the fourth book, but it sounds like you were. So
yeah.
I don't know. Any comments on that?
I always knew there were going to be four books. I knew that it would pretty much end the way the last chapter ends. With Alicia, I don't know. This is an example of things happening, which are, the book didn't turn out exactly. It took a detour in the middle of it, and that story was just finished. So
yeah,
I don't know if I have a good answer for you on that one, Jay. It's just the way it worked out. Would I go back and do it the same way? I don't know. Maybe.
Well, honestly, I like book three a lot.
Oh, good.
I mean, I like them all, but yeah, I really do like that one.
So you did your research. I'm impressed.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get too into it because this is about you and not me. I've been researching Indiana Jones. And so, yeah, I recently read all four of your novels.
Oh,
and then, you know, I've read Ophelia and a couple others. But
Oh, cool. Good. I'm impressed.
Let's see. Okay. So, again, this is a little bit of a personal question for me, but you came up with the Crystal Skull MacGuffin. Did Lucasfilm or anyone ever say, hey, thank you for Like, you connected Indy to that, and now we're using this in our movie. Did you ever get any credit for that?
No, I didn't.
Are you just, like, out of contact with Lucasfilm after you finished yours, or?
No, I still have maintained some contacts with the individuals there, at least until the sale to Disney. So it was very cordial. It was very, and it was always understood that George gets to do what whatever George wants with the stories. And I thought I was lucky to be invited into that world to contribute a little bit to it. So the books don't mesh exactly with the movies anymore, but that's okay. I mean, you know, their property, their character, and I was just happy to be a part of it. And I did get notes while I was writing the novels and for a time after that, you know, oh, good job on this, good job on that. Or we don't really want Indy to do this in this chapter. And one of the conversations was with the licensing people and not with not with Lucas himself or others or his second in command, Lucy Autry Wilson, who is just wonderful. And I would get Christmas cards from her for a long time.
Oh, that's cool.
But the question was, are these books for adults or are they for children? And this was a continuing tension throughout all of them because Lucasfilm Licensing believed that they were for children. Oh. And I thought that I was writing them for everyone, that we shouldn't just limit it. And this goes all the way down to what do you call Indy in the books? Is he Indy or is he Jones? So I had a feeling that Indy was a little too young adult. So I did not want to call him Indy in the books, but Lucasfilm won out on that one. So the first book, we had to change all the references to Indy instead of Jones. And I was lobbying for Jones because if you think about the first movie, I was lobbying for Jones and for the books to be a little more geared toward adults. Think how the amount of tension and the themes in that first movie in Raiders, and it really is a pretty sophisticated story and probably not one for children. Now, as the films went on, they seemed to drift a little bit in terms of the relationship to the audience and who the audience was expected to be. But when I was writing the stories for me as the first fan, as being a fan of, you know, sitting in that drive-in movie theater in the rain and watching Indy. That's what I wanted to recreate in the books. I think I may have come close a couple times. So, and there's some times that, frankly, I didn't come so close. But it was a great adventure to be able to do that. Yep, I think you're frozen. Do I still have you?
Well, so I'm losing. Oh, are you still there?
Yeah, we're having a pretty good lag here. Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, I don't know if you left off with the question. I missed something there.
Okay. No, that's fine. I just about the tension between whether they're written for kids or whether they're for adults.
I recently read Rob McGregor's novels too, and I felt like his were young adult novels, and I like them, but I like that yours are more adult too. And to me, that seemed like a really good choice.
yeah, he did a great job. I mean, Rob was very dedicated to it, and he was enthusiastic and a good writer. So, he did a good job. I tried to do my best. Some of the people that came after did good jobs as well. But, you know, it's tough, the amount of pressure in terms of being handed a franchise that everyone knows, that everyone has heard of. It was surprising the amount of pressure that I felt going into it. And then as I started writing them, that got a little easier. Now, it did take me longer to write them than Bantam would have liked. So, but after the first one, they were okay with it and gave me the time, and Lucasfilm gave me the time I needed. But they weren't as easy to plot and to do as I thought they might have been in the first. Mm-hmm. So,
how did you come up with the MacGuffins for each of those? Were those obvious, or did you have some on the table that Lucasfilm said no? Or
I did have some that they said no to. It took me like 30 minutes to come up with the list of ideas for each of the books. And this ties into my interest in bizarre and weird and Fortean things. My number one item that I wanted to do was the Spear of Destiny. And I didn't get to do it because they had just come out with the comic book. Dark Horse had come out with a comic book that had the Spear of Destiny as the MacGuffin in it. And that was crushing to me. I didn't know about this. And so they said, no, you can't do this. So then I went to next on my list. It was Philosopher's Stone, and then wrote a quick synopsis of it and sent it to them. But I had a choice of probably 20 different things. Now, some of them I couldn't do because they were planning adventures in the Bible. They for the Indie Bible, they had said they were planning, they were reserving some things for the future. And so those were off limits. Some of the ones you might think about and thinking about, what artifacts would Indy go after? Some of those were off the table, but I was really happy to do Philosopher's Stone and the dinosaur eggs and the Sphinx and the Hollow Earth. They were great fun.
Yeah. Cool. Let's see. So I don't want to make you take a stance on this, but so I'm just going to say some of the Indiana Jones movies are better than others. And I guess I want to ask this question a little more generally, that a lot of times there are stories that have the trappings of a great story, but they're missing the heart. And do you know what the heart of a good story is? And when you see that that's missing, maybe in a big Hollywood blockbuster, like, what is that heart that's missing? Like, it, on the surface, it looks like they did everything right, but there's something missing. And what is that?
Well, I will say this about the indie movies. The first three are my favorite. The number one is my all-time favorite, and it is so difficult to make a movie. And having had some experience with this, I'm not going to criticize anyone else's effort because I understand the passion and the hard work that goes into it. And it's great that when everything works out, we have a movie that we can love. In terms of what is the heart, I'm going to go back to Joseph Campbell. And you probably know the story of Chris Vogler's $1 million memo. Have you heard this story? I'm sure you have.
I don't think so.
Chris Vogler was a reader of was a screenplay reader in Hollywood, and he was thinking about just this issue of what makes a great story. How does a story transcend the trappings of it, the costumes, to really become a classic, to really reach people in a way that is meaningful. And he wrote a memo thinking about this, and he used The Wizard of Oz as an example of a movie that succeeds on every level. And he said, well, what the movies that really succeed, like The Wizard of Oz and many others, is that they all conform to Joseph Campbell's idea of the hero's journey, the monomyth. And Vogler cited a 1949 book that Campbell had written called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And Campbell was a mythologist, and he taught at Sarah Lawrence College. And he was a mythologist in the sense that he studied stories around the world. And he he found this, that there is really one adventure story in the world, and it keeps getting told over and over again, that the names and the circumstances change, but there are certain elements that remain the same. And you can, this is not a formula, because you can put these elements in a different way and it still works. You don't have to have all the elements every time, but in general, here is the story that you have someone who's living their ordinary everyday life. And it can be man, woman, sometimes it's animals. It can even be, think of Christmas stories. It can be a toy. So when Campbell uses the word hero and I use the word hero, I'm not just thinking of, you know, a two-fisted action hero. This can be anyone. But they're living their ordinary everyday life. And then something happens that is a call to adventure. And this call to adventure asks them to be their true authentic selves. And in the Wizard of Oz, it's easy to know what the call to adventure is. It's a tornado which transports Dorothy to Oz. And she tries to run away at first. But you always have to be acting on something that's on behalf of something that is bigger than yourself. Can't be just purely greed or something like that. And there's going to be helpers and hinderers along the way. But the most important thing is that the hero that she has to learn, that she always had it within herself to succeed. And you see this in The Wizard of Oz, in that Dorothy learns that a couple times that she had it within herself to succeed. First, when she discovers that it was just water, she just had to throw water on the Wicked Witch to defeat her. And then in the end, where she thinks she's stuck in Oz and she wants to go home, and Glinda the Good Witch appears and says, you just have to tap your heels together three times and say, there's no place like home. Lucas had the hero's journey foremost in mind when he wrote Star Wars. He used this as really his inspiration. Vogler eventually wrote a book called The Writer's Journey, which is about this. And I recommend that highly.
Yeah, I know this
to those who, yeah. And I was lucky enough to talk with Vogler. He came to a writer's conference that I'm the president of in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, a few years ago. And he spoke to the crowd and we got to talk. I got to talk to him about the memo, and he was a really nice guy and did a great job. But it was interesting to hear it firsthand from him. Mm-hmm. Now, Campbell didn't use The Wizard of Oz, or he used stories from around the world, particularly coming-of-age stories, cultural stories. But Vogler bridged that gap, and he said, okay, well, here are the roots of what drive us to stories, that it's not just for entertainment, that we're getting something that human beings need. We're getting emotional sustenance, encouragement, and wisdom from these stories, and that's what keeps us going back to the movies or keeps us reaching for the next novel.
Dang, that's cool. Okay, yeah, I'm going to go read his book. That sounds awesome. Yeah. So we're almost out of time. Let me ask you one writing question, then I'll ask you some rapid-fire questions.
Sure.
I feel like your style, you're able to say a lot with few words. You're just very concise, but that doesn't mean you're missing pieces. Like, I feel like it's very clear and very vivid, but concise. And so I'm curious, is that a habit you've trained? Is that a editing? Like, you do that all in editing? And then along with those questions, how does one learn this skill?
Well, I attribute my journalistic experience to being able to write concisely, and there's that helps a lot. Also, I remember a piece that I read from a piece of advice from Isaac Asimov, who said that he always tried to get it right on the first draft. And so I really took that to heart, because I hate editing and rewriting. It's necessary. Mm-hmm. We all have to do it. I'm not saying don't edit, don't rewrite, but I try as hard as I can to get it right on the first draft. And so I think that helps. The other thing that I do that I think helps is that I structure my stories pretty carefully, to the point of not just having an outline, but I have I storyboard the stories that I will draw scenes and mix them up and change them around. And that works for me better than doing an outline. I can make a sketch of the scene. And I did this with Ophelia Wilde, the whole book. I will make a sketch of the scene on a piece of cardstock and then make a few notes on it and then put it aside. Then if I come up with another scene, and then eventually you've got 60 or 70 scenes and you can move them around. And it works really well. And I learned to do this writing screenplays. And I've optioned a few screenplays, haven't had anything made to speak of, but screenplays help me with that. So to think about story in that way.
Dang, that's so cool. I want to see these cards and how you draw these. This sounds cool.
I'm a bad artist, but yeah.
But you get the point, I guess, apparently. Mm-hmm. Well, and so what does one of your outlines look like? Are these pages and pages, or how detailed are they?
They will be not that detailed. My outlines have to do with, I don't even break it up into chapters. I think more in terms of scenes, and I will do the storyboards. I will make notes in my journal. In my journal is on one side of the journal, I have all my notes about the facts and the books I've read that go along with that and where I can find the research. And on the other page, I have the outline and notes for the stories. And so the outline tends to start out as a collection of notes. And sometimes I may write a note on a receipt or something and put it in my wallet, or I may scribble something on my on notes and on my iPhone. And then I gather those together and look through them, and then I'll create a timeline. I'll create a chronology. Now, I usually do not stick chronologically, as you probably know, in telling my stories, but I will make a chronology so I know what happens when, and then I'll slice it up into chapters and then rearrange it, and with always knowing what the ending of the story is going to be, and I work toward that. And then after I have the outline, and I try to avoid putting dialogue in the outlines. I tried to do that a couple times. It just didn't work for me. I know a lot of writers it does work for. Didn't work for me. It kind of slowed everything down. But then after I have the outline, I'm satisfied with it. Then I just start writing, and then pretty much abandon the outline because I can remember what I know what the outline is. I don't have to refer to it too much. And then I usually take a detour or two by the time I get to where the final scene is.
Cool.
and you know, along with that, there's, sometimes I'll do my own sketches. I'll refer to pictures of places I've been or that I know that I want to, put into it or stories that I want to include. So it tends to be a big sprawling project. And when I have working on a book, I may have 30, reference books, scattered out across the room. I'll have stacks of notes and papers. Really, it looks like a bomb went off by the time I get to the end of the book. And the very last thing I do when I finish the book is then gather all these pieces, put the books back, return the books if they're from a library, organize the notes, put those in a box and label them, and then clean up the space for the next project. And then another bomb goes off. So,
okay. Let me ask you, these are just rapid fire questions. Sure. We'll try to get through 10 of them in a couple minutes, but, which of your books, so this actually comes from someone on Reddit. I mentioned that I was going to interview you. Mm-hmm. Which of your books would be your first pick to be made into a movie? And I think you better answer that generally and for Indiana Jones.
Oh, okay. Well, for generally, The Moon Pool is, that's the thriller I talked about that is set in the world of cave diving. It's actually set in Missouri at a place called Bon Terre, a real place. And there's a flooded mine there. Mm-hmm. And it's about the world's, only private underwater detective, a guy by the name of Richard Dahlgren. And, it began as a screenplay. And I had optioned the screenplay early on, and way back in the 90s, and it never got made. And then when that option expired, I wrote it as a novel and updated it, and it came out in 2004. I think it's the most, it's the best structured and the most visual of my novels, my own novels, in terms of that would make a great movie. And now the technology is finally catching up to where you could do all the underwater stuff and not have a Jim Cameron type budget to go along with it. Cause that was the problem with the, after I optioned it, cause it was just going to cost so much money to make. And there were so many underwater scenes. But I like the novel. I think the novel turned out even better than the screenplay. So, so I think that would be my, the top one of the Indiana Jones books of mine. That's a really tough question because I like the overarching story of, of the skull, and I'd hate to leave that out. So I'm going to have a, I'm going to break the rules here a little bit. I'm going to say, I want to keep that overarching story, and have that in it. But my favorite of those stories is Hollow Earth.
So, oh, cool. Yeah. 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 That one really stood out to me too. Some of your indie fans have asked if your indie books will be made into ebooks or audiobooks. Do you happen to know anything from the publisher whether that would ever happen?
I don't. That's a great question. I hope they are soon. I know they every few years Bantam will re-release them in new editions, and that's happened a couple times. But I don't know of any plans for. Or ebooks or audiobooks.
Well, and so. you've heard there's a fifth Indiana Jones movie coming soon. I would hope that, I mean, they could ride that wave, and I think your books need to be out there, but
thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay. Who beta reads your books?
My wife, Kim, is my best reader, and we've been married since 2011. And so she hasn't read all my books, but, she really has become, a great reader. And we never actually disagree on things, but she will point out insights or things that I need to think about that I didn't. I'm being vague here. Let me tell you exactly what she will tell me is that she will tell me that, oh, you're avoiding this. Is there some reason you didn't go where you should with this? Or, why aren't you addressing this, in a more direct way? You're throwing away the dramatic potential here. And she did this with, Ophelia in a couple of places. In terms of particularly the scene where Ophelia, without giving out too much, but where Ophelia is buried alive early on in the first book. And she had some really pointed questions about that. And she has made it a better book. She also proofs my newspaper columns and my other writing. Most of my other writing, I get some of the same comments from her. She has an excellent ear in terms of word choice and dialogue. She's a poet. And so it comes to her naturally. But she doesn't think she's a very good reader, but she really is. She doesn't think she's a very good copy editor, I'm very fortunate to have her.
It's priceless.
Read those.
What book are you working on now?
I'm working on a couple of different projects. I've written a couple of historical Westerns set in the fur trade in the 1820s, and they are quirky, like many of my other books. They're not what you'd expect for a Western set in the fur trade era, which I hope is good. So working on the third book in that series. And I'm also have gotten interested in the Bender murders again. and have recently become acquainted with the guy who recently purchased the property. It was off limits for a very long time. A family had it. They farmed it. They didn't want anyone on the property. A gentleman who had grown up in that neck of the woods and knew this story really well got interested in it. He bought it. Mm-hmm. And so for a newspaper column, a couple of years ago, I knew the property had been up for sale. And this year is the 150th anniversary of the Bender murders, by the way. But I found out who had bought the property. And I just called him up and I said, hey, I want to do this newspaper column about this. Will you tour the property? You let me tour the property. He said, sure. And so we became good friends and we walked over the property and he has got a team of archaeologists from a university that's going to come in and do a proper site study. And I'm thinking of the novel possibilities here. So that's in the percolating stages, I should say.
Yeah, that's super cool.
So we'll see what happens with that.
There's a presumption here, but what book are you going to read tonight?
Oh, that's a pretty fair presumption, a pretty safe bet that I would be reading a book tonight. And the book I'm reading right now is a biography of, is it a biography? Should I call it a biography? It's a nonfiction book about the song Wichita Lineman.
That's cool.
It's fascinating. And about the, it's not written by Jimmy Webb, but Jimmy Webb is interviewed in it. And you know, I'm blanking on the author. I apologize to the author of the book, but I cannot think of the author right off the top of my head. So that's the one that I'm just now finishing
up. Cool. What is the one book? This is the last question, by the way. What is the one book that has had the greatest impact on your life?
Huckleberry Finn.
That's cool.
for all the obvious reasons and some things that may not be so obvious. As you know, that Missouri figures prominently in many of my historical books. So there's that. I'm also a Mark Twain researcher. I've written a lot of nonfiction about Mark Twain and done some scholarship. But it is what Huck says at the end of Huckleberry Finn, which really gets me every time, and that is that if he'd known it had been so much trouble to write a book, he wouldn't have tried it in the first place. So I keep forgetting that. After every time I finish a book, I swear that I'm never going to do another one and give it a few weeks, and then I'm working on a new one.
Yeah. So. Excellent. So I would love to give you the final words. I don't know if you have something to ask our listeners or an invitation, or maybe there's a question that I should have asked you and you want to answer that. What do you want to say as your parting words?
Well, Jay, you had great questions. And I really enjoyed spending the time with you. I'm going to give a suggestion for your audience in terms of if they're stuck in, and I can't claim this when another writer told me about it. And it sounds crazy, but it works. If you're stuck on your story, that an effective thing to do is to interview yourself in the mirror and record it, record the interviews and ask yourself as if you were an interviewer, someone else, keep it in the third person, and your answers might surprise you. That what kind of trouble are you having with the story? Why are you stuck on chapter 3? Why don't you know what really the end of act 2 is? Why are you having such such trouble with a particular character? You know, it sounds hokey, but I can attest that it does work. So that's my best piece of advice.
Excellent.
Today, anyway. Okay.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure for me. And to our listeners, it's time to start writing.
It's been fun. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
So there you have it. That was our interview with Max McCoy. I hope you enjoyed it. I really admire him, and it was a privilege to get to ask him those questions. I told you at the beginning that I would tell you about the project I've been working on. So a while ago, I had this idea to write something called Stealing Indiana Jones. And you've heard me. This is a weird quirk that I have, but I tend to start writing novels with the title. And this title popped into my head, Stealing Indiana Jones. And I was going to write about this is where the people who made Indiana Jones got their ideas from. And then I kind of wanted to expand that into this is how artists come up with their ideas. So this is going to be a story about inspiration. And as I started drafting this, finally, you know, I'd been thinking about it for years, but I finally started drafting it. And as I was drafting, it started to be a story about my brother who passed away, because he and I, as kids, were deeply into Indiana Jones and Star Wars. And this essay started to also be the story of us. And then it also kind of became this story about personal tragedy and how I personally have dealt with death. So it's kind of light and fun, and it's about being a kid in the 90s. And it's also kind of this heavy manuscript about dealing with the death of someone who's really close to you. And I am very proud of this. It's a short piece. I recently recorded the audiobook. It's available on Audible now. And I got to narrate it. And that was a lot of fun. So right now I'm just going to play you, which is what is essentially the back cover blurb from Stealing Indiana Jones. And I hope you enjoy it. If you're interested in reading it, you can find it on Amazon, or anybody who signs up for my newsletter, I send them a free copy of this ebook. And you can do that at theinformant.jwashburn.com, or just look down in the show notes of this podcast and you'll see a link to it. And without further ado, here's the back cover blurb for Stealing Indiana Jones. Stealing Indy will pique your intellect and break your heart. James Wolfhampton. In 1990, a 6-year-old boy stole something from his neighbors. A small book. The ultimate Indiana Jones treasure. A Grail diary. It promised everlasting life, but because it was stolen, the little boy didn't dare tell his older brother, his mentor, what he'd done. In 2020, 30 years later, that older brother passed away. Stealing Indiana Jones is the true story of these two boys and how they discover a monstrous secret that George Lucas stole his ideas for both Star Wars and Indiana Jones. As they struggle to make sense of what this horrifying truth means for all of us fans, they find redemption along the way. Their story explores inspiration and how great stories come to life. It examines, without shying away, disillusionment and innocence doomed to die. Their story is a salute to the loss of childhood and to the loss of life. Stealing Indiana Jones is a journey through the 90s, a glimpse of boyhood and fandom, and it's filled with both heartbreak and heroism. Most importantly, it's a quest to uncover the secret behind all great stories, the secret of immortality.